when, I think was it about 18, we went down to Mexico to write some songs. We ended up accidentally on this drug bust. It's a whole other story. But there is a picture on his website, pulse.com, of me holding an AK-47 and him a kilo of marijuana. But again, that's a whole other story. And we wrote three songs on that trip, and this song was one of them. We were kind of just trying to figure out, we both had a record deal, and it was our first record, I think, for both of us. And we were trying to figure out who would record it, and so after a gig at 3 a.m., we went to this taco stand in Crescent Heights or something, Hillcrest in San Diego, and there were some prostitutes there eating burritos. And we decided to sing them, each sing them the song, and let them decide who sang it better. And anyway, they thought I sang it better, and so I recorded it. And this is that song.
It's true, it's true.
Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And this week we have a real treat in store for you. We are going to be joined by singer, songwriter, and all-around great guy, Steve Pultz. Now, on the surface, the name Steve Pultz may not strike familiarity with all of you, but that's okay. That only means you're in for a real special episode. Steve has written songs that you definitely know, and today he's going to tell us the stories behind the hits, behind his life, and what it means to be a professional songwriter, doing the work and putting in the time necessary to hone his craft. And as a bonus, Steve is going to give the Vinyl Guide listeners an exclusive performance of one of his new songs. Plus, today we're going to have an update on some vinyl in the news and talk about some upcoming releases you may not be aware of. And it's all thanks to show sponsor GrooveWasher.com. Dirty records are a great way to destroy your gear and ruin your stylus. Keep your records clean with the Groove Washer record cleaning system, available at GrooveWasher.com. And we're also sponsored by Voyage Air Guitars. Guitar players, check out the portable design of the Voyage Air Guitar. There's nothing like it, and it's available at VoyageAirGuitar.com. And with that, let's talk to singer, songwriter, and troubadour Steve Pultz.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Hola, amigos. ¿Cómo está? Konnichiwa. Good day, mate. Howdy, hello, and hey, what is in the fridge? It's Nate here, host of this crazy podcast made especially for you vinyl record nuts out there. How y'all doing? Had a good week? Find some good records lately? Well, I know you have. I've been watching your posts and tags on facebook.com/vinylguide and, of course, on Instagram, instagram.com/vinylguide. Thanks for sharing, by the way. Always like to see what you folks are taking home. Also had some great feedback on last week's episode, which featured Angelo Moore of Fishbone. You guys seem to really enjoy that one. Angelo is a no-holds-barred type of guy, willing to talk about and really answer anything. So it was great we got to talk to him. And incidentally, we also got to see him live here in Sydney at the David Bowie tribute at the Sydney Opera House. And that was a lot of fun. I posted some pictures on it. And let me tell you, Angelo, you know, there were so many great musicians around that David Bowie tribute. It was these musicians who had worked with David Bowie in the past, and they were playing different songs of his catalog. And every time Angelo came out and took the lead vocals, the place just erupted. He was truly, you know, one of the many highlights of the evening. So again, thanks, Angelo, for stopping by the Vinyl Guide and for hanging out here in Sydney. For those of you who haven't heard last week's episode, make sure to check it out. I suggest you do it soon, and it's all available and waiting for you over at thevinylguide.com. So on this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, I think you guys are really going to enjoy our conversation we had with Steve Pultz. Now again, many of you may not know Steve by name, but you've certainly heard his work. Steve's a songwriter who's worked for many years in the business. He's written songs for the likes of Jewel and other recording artists. He co-wrote Jewel's big hit, You Were Meant For Me. And today he talks about how that song went from idea, you know, just germinating to fully fledged inferno of cultural awareness. I mean, this is a song that's been covered by hundreds of performers. It's been featured in movies, TV shows, made into grocery store music even. And I bet if I started playing it now, each of you would know the words. It's a very catchy song. It's very well written, very well structured, and it just works. It's touched a lot of people. It's a song that's really made its mark. And it's just one of hundreds of songs that Steve has written and performed. So today, Steve's going to join us. He's going to talk about his career, his life, his experiences, how he writes songs, what it was like to have such a life-changing event as a number one song in the country. I mean, that's a huge thing for any artist, any performer, to have that sort of recognition. And yet Steve remains humble and committed to doing the work, you know, putting in the time. He continues to professionally play over 250 dates each year. He's traveling constantly, writing songs every week, creating every day, recording every few months. This is Steve's life, and quite honestly, I've been privileged to have known Steve for many years, seeing him live a dozen times or so, hanging out, and just really enjoying his life vicariously. Steve's got a good thing going, and recently he was in Sydney, and we did a bit of a sit-down talk, which you'll hear today. And as a bit of a bonus, Steve performed an exclusive song just for the Vinyl Guide listeners. So it's really awesome. It's a track called Folk Singer. For those of you who know Steve's work, this may be one of your favorites. For those of you who don't, this is going to be a great introduction. It's going to give you a bit of perspective on who Steve is, what he does, and hopefully strike you right where it counts, and you'll want to hear more from him, which you can do so right now at Poltz.com. That's Poltz.com. There you can get songs, buy music, check out his tour dates. Steve is constantly touring, so he'll definitely be in your area at some point soon. Hell, he plays everywhere, so hopefully you'll be able to see him live. So enjoy today's interview and check out Poltz.com for more information. So that's it for today's upfronts. We'll have a bit of record news and then get to our conversation with Steve Poltz right after this. GrooveWasher.com. You guys know I love my GrooveWasher record cleaning system. Look, I have a heap of records, and I play them all the time. So if anyone should have a record cleaning machine, it's me, right? Well, look, I say nuts to that. All I really need is the GrooveWasher record cleaning system. The GrooveWasher comes with a specifically designed fluid that lifts the grime from deep within the record groove and a brush that carries it away. It's that simple. Plus, the groove washer reduces the static cling from the records, and that's what attracts a lot of the debris in the first place. So not only is the groove washer totally simple, easy to use, and extremely effective, but it's also very affordable. Head on over to groovewasher.com, and you could pick up a kit starting at around $50 for the starter kit, and then you could add some accessories from there. And for you record retailers, did you know you can stock the groove washer in your record store? Yes siree, there is a Groove Washer retail kit as well, so you can get your customers involved in the best manual record cleaning system on Earth, and likely Mars and Jupiter too. So, whoever you are, or should I say whomever you are, if you have records, if you play records, if you enjoy records, then treat them well. Get a Groove Washer record cleaning system today. That's groovewasher.com, and they are made in the USA. Now, I know that many of you record collectors are also musicians, so let me share with you a word on Voyage Air guitars. Guitars are fun to play, they're great to carry around, but they're pretty awkward. You have this body of the guitar, and then you have this long, thinnish, exposed neck, which could be subject to damage when you transport it. Now, I'm sure you've all seen and heard the horror stories of airlines damaging guitars in transit. However, with a Voyage Air guitar, you don't need to worry about that. Voyage Air guitars have a patented hinge system, which allows the neck to fold down for protection and allowing easy access for storage and transportation. And when it's time to play, simply unfold the neck and voila, instantly playable guitar with tuned strings. Now, I've used these guitars before. The system they have is incredible. You got to see it for yourself. Go to voyageairguitar.com or ask your local guitar dealer how you can check out this amazing guitar system. Never worry again about your guitar. Get yourself a Voyage Air guitar. The future is unfolding. All right, well, thank you very much, show sponsors, GrooveWasher.com and VoyageAirGuitar.com. Much appreciated. All right, real quick, I get a lot of email and links and direction over to news and activities and events for the sort of things that happen in the vinyl record world. You know, things of interest, like a pressing plant is opening in a city over there, or an artist is re-releasing their legendary catalog over there, you know. So I tend to collect a lot of that information, and I don't get a chance to talk about it a lot here on the show. In fact, quite often I put those links, that information, up on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/vinylguide. If you haven't gone there already, go there, like it, and then you'll get those stories in your feed. Anyway, what I wanted to do today was highlight a couple of stories that I think were particularly interesting, especially to us vinyl collectors. So what I wanted to do today was introduce a brand new segment to the show.
We interrupt this podcast to bring you a record nerd news bulletin from the Vinyl Guide News Network. For the update, here's your anchorman, Nate Goyer.
Well, that almost sounded professional. Yeah, this is Nate. Let me go through some vinyl record news here for you. Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails. Most of you know Trent and Nine Inch Nails and are familiar with his work. He recently wrote a manifesto outlining his intent to revive the vinyl availability of his catalog of music, which is quite vast, actually. He wrote what is called a vinyl mission statement, and it's up on his website, nin.com. And he writes, and it's quite lengthy, but I'll just paraphrase a few bits. He writes, quote, "In these times of nearly unlimited access to all the music in the world, we've come to appreciate the value and beauty of the physical object. Our stores," I mean the Nine Inch Nails stores, "focus is on presenting these items to you. Vinyl has returned to being a priority for us, not just for the warmth of sound, but for the interaction it demands from the listener." Blah, 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 blah. So he continues on talking about why vinyl, why he's now going to reissue a lot of the Nine Inch Nails music on vinyl. So to back up his newly returned vinyl passion, there are several albums from Nine Inch Nails that were out of print on vinyl, some for decades, and they're now being repressed and available to order. Starting from Pretty Hate Machine, to Broken, to The Fragile, and many more. And they can be available. You can see them at nin.com. And I think they're quite reasonable prices. You know, The Fragile, for instance, it's a 3-LP set and an original pressing from 1999, which is the only time they pressed it up to now. An original pressing from 1999 typically goes for around $300, sometimes more. And right now, the 2017 Definitive Edition, which they call it, the 2017 Definitive Edition, which still features the 3 LPs and a digital download, is only $45. And look, knowing Trent and his, you know, penchant, I guess, his interest in the audio world, I'm sure these are not cheap reissues. I'm sure there's some sort of remastering, some sort of activity that's happened behind to make sure that it's a quality product. All right, I trust the guy that much. I don't know that for a fact, but I just trust the guy to that. Also, another example of what's being released: original pressings of the EP Broken. That was kind of one of his breakthrough, really heavy industrial pieces, the one that really kind of helped define his sound. Broken, the original pressing was a 12-inch LP and a 7-inch single. And again, if you look for one of those issues, those original issues from the mid-90s, those go for about $150. So now you can order one directly from NIN.com, the 2017 version, for $25. So yeah, it's all available on NIN.com. There's a whole bunch of different albums from his catalog that are available. Some that look like they're going to become available. They said, you know, coming soon. Some of them you can order right now. And the prices are pretty good. Trent seems to be skipping the middleman and going straight to consumers, which is good news for us. So I've already placed my orders. If you're a Nine Inch Nails fan, I suggest you do the same, because as quickly as the door is opened, it can certainly shut just as fast. All right, let's talk quickly about Ben Folds, easily one of our generation's musical heroes. He's also been making his back catalog available on vinyl again. And for many years, two of his really particularly brilliant LPs, Rocking the Suburbs and Songs for Silverman. They were out of print and commanding hundreds of dollars each. Now, I know that because I've got a copy of each one, and yeah, they didn't come cheap, but I'm glad I have them. So recently, the Rocking the Suburbs album was available again, and you can purchase that wherever you purchase records. And also coming up in February, a repressing of Songs for Silverman will be available. This is also alongside the vinyl version of the new Ben Folds 5 LP, Unauthorized Biography of Reinhold Messner. So same date, I think February 17th is when they're going to be shipping them. So again, I recommend getting a copy of Songs for Silverman and Rocking the Suburbs while they're available, because again, if they sell out, there's no promising they'll be available again anytime soon. And also one final bit of vinyl record information you're going to want to know about. There's a band, Crystal Fairy, and it's a collaboration between Buzz and Dale of the Melvins, Omar from Omar Rodriguez Lopez from the Mars Volta and At the Drive-In, and Terry Genderbender from Les Boucherettes. They formed a band called Crystal Fairy. They've made their debut album for Ipecac Records. It's available on February 24th, and there's a pre-order, a special limited run of pink vinyl available at Ipecac Records. I've heard the LP. It is great. I've certainly ordered my pink vinyl version, and it's a limited pressing. This is kind of generally what they do when they announce a new album. They have a limited set of pressings of the pink vinyl. If you're too late for getting the pink vinyl, that's okay too. Get the black one because it is a great album. And besides, look for Buzz Osborne very shortly on an upcoming episode of The Vinyl Guide where he talks Crystal Fairy and all sorts of other vinyl record shenanigans.
That was a Record Nerd News Bulletin from the Vinyl Guide News Network. Now back to our regularly scheduled podcast, already in progress.
Let's get to our conversation with singer and songwriter Steve Poltz. So here on The Vinyl Guide, we're always talking to musicians and music makers and folks that are in the industry. And today I'm very pleased to welcome Steve Poltz. He's a songsmith, a troubadour, a balladeer, a poet. And I want to introduce you to him because I think he's a really remarkable guy and very talented as well. And after this podcast, I think you'll never forget Steve Poltz. How are you doing, Steve?
Good. It's just funny to hear you introduce me because I was on the radio once and it was a morning show and the guy said, Steve Poltz is coming on. And people thought he said Steel Pulse. And so he said my name twice. I was Steel Pulse. And I guess people weren't listening and they showed up at my show, but they were reggae fans. Mm. So I walked out on stage and I'm just like this skinny white guy. And people were so bummed when I walked out on stage. Like, so I tried to do my songs with a reggae beat.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't totally working.
No.
So for some reason, I just had a flashback.
How quickly could you do a switch around?
It was hard to do.
Yeah.
I tried.
Did you win them over?
Some of them.
Yeah.
Some walked out.
Okay. After they paid, though.
One time I opened for Styx. Mm. Remember Styx?
Which, like, so it would be the Styx with or without James Young?
Dennis DeYoung.
Dennis DeYoung. Oh, yeah, the head guy. Was it with or without them?
It was without him.
Okay, all right.
So what it was they had a huge falling out. So Dennis DeYoung would travel as the voice of Styx. Tommy Shaw was still in Styx. Mm-hmm. So they had these other guys to sing. And so Dennis DeYoung can only travel as the voice of Styx, whereas Styx got to keep the name, mm-hmm. and they hate Dennis, and Dennis hates them.
Right.
So my booking agent was like, hey, you want to open for Styx? And I had an off night, and I was like, yeah. That's how it is, mm-hmm. you know, in the folk world.
Sure,
you got to take the gigs. They were like, we'll give you like $200. And so it was in a place called Jacksonville, Oregon, mm-hmm. which is like a tertiary sea market. Mm-hmm. Like it's not even Jacksonville, Florida. Jacksonville, Oregon.
Right, yeah.
And that's at a place called the Brit Pavilion, B-R-I-T-T.
Okay.
Now at the Brit Pavilion.
That sounds like a pub.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it's a pavilion. It's like a shed, outdoor show.
Okay.
So at the Brit Pavilion, people will line up, and then when they open the doors, they run in because it's festival seating, and just to get the best seats. So you see like 200-pound freaking overweight people, like 200 pounds overweight, like diabetics and stuff running to get seats, like people collapsing on the ground in diabetic coma, somebody having a heart attack, another person having a stroke, and they get just to get their seats to see Styx. So I'm not listed anywhere on the tickets. All it says is Styx, presented by this classic rock station that plays all the classic rock songs. So the DJ comes out and he goes, "Hey, everybody, I'm Wild Tony from the Morning Zoo Show here on KMMFE." And he goes, "It's so great to have you here tonight. I'll be so excited to see Styx." And the place is going nuts. He goes, "Domo arigato." And they go, "Mr. Roboto." He goes, "Come sail away." And they go, "With me. Come sail away. Come sail away with me." And then, "Lady." And then the crowd goes, "When I'm with you, I'm smiling." He goes, "It's going to be the greatest show. Are you ready? Are you ready to rock?" Yeah. And they're going nuts. And he goes, "But first, please put your hands together for Steve Pultz." And it was the sound of one hand clapping as I walked out. And there were three girls there to see me wearing my T-shirts. The shirt you're wearing, actually.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And all three of them stand up. And that's all you hear amongst 3,000 people in an outdoor amphitheater. And people are giving them dirty looks for even cheering for me. So I play the show. And afterwards, I go, "Hey, I'll be at the merch stand if you guys want to come by." And I'm trying to win over a Styx crowd, right, with solo guy and acoustic guitar. I'm doing everything but performing in blackface. Like, "Hello, my baby. Hello, my darling. Hello, my ragtime girl. Swanee, oh, I love you. Oh, I love you." Like, anything to win them over. I just
Please
felt,
like me.
Yeah, I felt terrible about myself when it ended. Like, I was just patronizing, doing anything I could, just so they wouldn't throw things at me. So I go over to the merch den, and this guy comes up, and he's got a fanny pack on, which in Australia is what you call just a...
a lame packer.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a thing you wear. I know a fanny
a belly
is
a bag or whatever.
Pussy here. Mm. So, but it's a belly bag, yeah. So he's wearing a fanny pack. And he's waiting in line. Not that there was a huge line, by the way. Mm. Like, he's waiting. He's the third person of three people to get CDs. And he's got a mullet haircut. And he's drinking a Bud Light in a koozie. And he gets really close to me. He's got Bud Light and garlic fry breath because they're selling garlic fries. Mm-hmm. And he goes, "Hey, man, I just want to say," and he goes to shake my hand, and I've always been scared when people come up to me, if I don't know who they are, because I saw this movie called The Candidate starring Robert Redford, where he's like, it was a 70s movie, and this guy walks up, hands him a Coke and a hot dog, and then punches him in the face, Robert Redford, he punches him. So I'm always a little scared, and I have a bit of trepidation, so this guy comes up, and he goes, "Hey, I just want to say, when you came out on stage, I hated you." He goes, "And then when you started playing your first song, I really fucking hated you." He goes, "And by the time you got to your second song, I hated you even more. I didn't think I could hate anybody so much." And then he goes, "I looked over at my wife, and she goes, I kind of like him. And that made me hate you even more. And then by your fourth or fifth song, my wife really liked you. And then since she liked you, I started going, hey, maybe this guy's not so bad." He goes, "And by your last song, I was like, this guy's okay. I think I'm going to buy a CD. So I'm here to buy a CD." It was like it took so long for that to come out, for him to say one positive thing, that I was already so beaten down. I felt like I'd been through my own EST program. And he finally bought the CD and left. And I just felt horrible about myself.
And that man is now your manager.
Yes, he's here right now. Johnny!
Bubba! Here, Bubba!
Cletus.
It's hot dog time.
Yeah. And the other funny thing I remember is they had all these Marshall stack amps, like 30 high. Mm-hmm. And I went to lift one of them and there was nothing in them. Okay. And it was the quietest stage volume. They all had in-ear monitors. I go, "What are these?" They go, "Oh, these are just fake. They just travel with them. They're totally light. We can lift five of them at a time." Five Marshall stacks at a time onto the truck. And it's all fake for show. Mm-hmm. And the keyboard player was on what I call a lazy Susan. Like, it spun all the way around, like on a table, so you could get the condiments you want. And he was playing the piano behind his back, and he was wearing a fanny pack and had a mullet and was flicking its tongue in the air and actually had a cold sore on his lip. So anyways, let's start this thing. That was a good start.
That was a great intro. Now, is that your worst opening story?
I think it is. Yeah. It ranks up there. There was a couple other bad ones. Mm-hmm. But that one's for – that one you get your bang for the buck.
Sure, sure. But look, that sounds like – overall, it's not too bad. You must play, I want to say, 200, 250 dates a year.
Yeah.
Right?
Easy.
Cruising around the world. You know, you've been doing this now for couple of decades now. You really spend more time off outside your house than you do inside.
Yeah, I quit my job in 1992.
That's the last job you've ever had. What was
my last job? I was a nipple salesman.
A nipple. Now, what is the job of a nipple salesman?
Well, a nipple is a threaded piece of PVC pipe or steel, but ours were PVC nipples, and you screw a sprinkler head on it. And so I sold them to irrigation contractors who would put in people's lawns and maybe, avocado fields and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. For trees.
And so you would sell nipples like, 100 at a time to these irrigation companies?
Yeah, to the contractors, to the distributors. So I had all these distributors and I would go to trade shows. This was my college job because I had a degree in political science with a minor in Spanish.
Okay.
So,
which is the gateway to a nipple salesman.
It's great training, yeah. It's like if you want to work in Silicon Valley, you study certain things. If you want to get in the nipple business, Spanish, minor, and political science.
Now, how would you make your nipple pitch in Spanish?
Oh, my gosh. ¿Dónde está el baño? ¿Tienes tacos? ¿Roll tacos con guacamole?
I think you need to go to remedial Spanish.
I do.
So you grew up in Southern California. Which part?
I grew up, we moved from Canada to Pasadena, California, and then my formative years were spent in Palm Springs, California.
What was it like in Palm Springs?
Hot, hot. I'm talking like Queensland hot, but without the humidity, it was a dry heat. Mm-hmm. So like 120 degree days in the summer, which is like, I guess like 45.
Yeah, 45. Yeah,
45 degrees. Mm-hmm. Screaming 45 degrees.
Now, Palm Springs is kind of the playground for a lot of the Hollywood folks. You ever see like Sinatra? You met Sinatra.
Okay. Yeah, shook his hand. The guy that lived across the street from us ran the airport. So he told us whenever anybody came in, Cher, Sonny and Cher. Mm. One day I would go to the spa to work out. I was running cross country and Cher would work out there and I'd run next to her and lift weights next to her and stuff. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then Elvis Presley, met Elvis.
You met Elvis?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
He, the guy that ran the airport called us and said that he'd be landing on a private plane. He goes, hey, Steve and Kath, my sister Kathy, said Elvis will be landing at 3 p.m. on a private plane and you guys can meet him if you'd like. And I freaked out because out of everybody, I was the biggest Elvis Presley
fan. How old were you at this point?
It was 1969. I was 9 years old.
All right.
And so he was like the Richard Nixon drug advisor and stuff. He was comeback special Elvis.
Oh, okay.
You know, he was looking good.
Cape wearing.
He was in, when he landed, the plane landed, and it was 120 degrees that day. Mm. You could see the heat rising off of the tarmac, and they let us ride our bikes on the tarmac. Like, obviously, it was pre-9/11.
Yeah.
We were wearing burkas and everything. They didn't care.
They didn't even search your turban.
No. Okay. So we ride our bikes on the tarmac, and then the plane lands, and the steps came down. We're just watching, and Elvis Presley stepped out, and we were about 200 feet away from him, and he just stood and looked at us, just me and my sister. So we laid our bikes down. We didn't know what to do. And he didn't come anywhere near us, but he waited for us to come to him without taking a step forward.
So it was
looking
like unspoken, like, you're coming to me.
Yeah, he had this charisma. Right. So we ran full speed, and I just jumped up into his arms, and he picked me up and put me on his shoulders, Elvis did. And I had a baseball cap on, and he's like, what's that? I go, Palm Springs Tramway. That's the baseball team, Little League team I play for. Took my hat off and put it on his head and ran his fingers through my hair and messed my hair all up, set me down. And then my sister already had boobs. She was older than me, so he hugged her for what seemed like, it was weird. I just remember it was like a longer hug. Like I got spun around on his shoulders, but he hugged her.
Yeah.
And then I remember I couldn't think of anything to say, so I said, it's okay, Elvis, you could have her. So he started laughing and he goes, your sister sure is pretty. And then he just talked to us.
You don't know how close that was, actually. Him and Priscilla and everything.
Yeah.
So you hung out with Elvis. You talked to him for a while.
Yeah. Okay. Then finally one of his assistants came up and said, come on, boss. We got to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got into a black limousine, a really long stretch black limo. And as it pulled away, it got smaller and smaller. He actually rolled down the back window and hung his head out of the window and kept waving to us. Like, it was one of the coolest things ever. He did not quit waving to us. Like, he was so giving.
Yeah.
And till the limo just, like, disappeared, into a mirage. And we rode our bikes home that night kind of high on the trail of success. And
that's like a movie scene.
It was beautiful.
Wow.
The day
I
met him.
Do you think he was high?
Of course. Yeah, he gave me some drugs. I was only 9.
Here you go, little boy. I want you to try one
of these. Sounds like your kid's been running.
Yeah, I got a new bag from Dr. Nick here. Why don't you take some of this? So you grew up in Palm Springs, and then at what point did you realize music was going to be a part of your life?
When I joined madrigals and folk mass in the Catholic Church. Mm. So I sang in the church choir, and then I joined madrigals when I was in 9th grade. And madrigals was like the top singing group. I was in concert choir, which was like 100 kids, but madrigals was like the top, I guess, like 12 singers, guys and girls. And you would learn all these really intense songs in other languages, like Fauna canzone senza notte nere, Fauna canzone senza
notte nere. Like the Latin Catholic song? Okay.
Se mai bramasti la mia grazia vera. We would compete against other schools. Mm. So it was the top singing group. And it was about that time that I got on the wrestling team, too. So I could never tell people on the wrestling team that I was in madrigals. It was like I had a secret life as a madrigal. Because just the name, the madrigals, and we'd wear these robes and travel.
It's kind of mystical, kind of, yeah.
It was, yes, you know, for lack of a better term, super gay. Mm. You know, the kind of gay where you get your butt kicked.
Right, yeah.
Especially in that town.
So you don't tell anyone you're from, but you had a connection to the music. You felt something through the music.
Mm-hmm.
It may not have been, was it spiritual, or was it just...
I was a natural. From the time I was 6, I saw Julian Bream play classical guitar. Mm-hmm. I got taken to his concert at the Hollywood Bowl by my gay uncle, Louie.
Mm-hmm.
And then Louie knew what he was doing. He said, what do you want to learn, piano, banjo, or classical guitar? After I'd just seen Julian Bream.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I want to learn classical guitar. So I learned classical guitar. So I had already been playing guitar since I was 6
mm-hmm.
and singing. And my uncle would bring boyfriends home, like at Christmas time, whoever he was dating, and I would do songs like from Oliver and Fiddler on the Roof. He would dress me up as Oliver,
okay.
and I would sing the songs. He would put on these musicals, and he was very theatrical. He died a couple years ago. I loved him so much. And so I always had the music in my soul.
Mm.
And then I was on the wrestling team, like I said, and then was playing, and I just kept singing and was always in the choir groups and then, you know, played in some bands. And.
Mm. So, but you started with like musicals.
Musicals.
And then you graduate, like at some point, what was your entry point into more popular music, rock or folk?
I got really into Barbra Streisand and Liza Minnelli because my uncle was into them. Mm. So my uncle would take me to Barbra Streisand movies, like What's Up, Doc? Yeah, The Way We Were. What's Up, Doc? On a Clear Day You Could See Forever. So I was really into On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. Mm-hmm. And then I got really into Liza Minnelli because my parents and my uncle took me to see Cabaret when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a huge fan of Joel Grey. Mm-hmm. He was the guy who did the MC in the movie Cabaret. Welcome, I'm bienvenue, welcome. And that was a great film. So I loved Liza Minnelli. And then I got into Neil Diamond, Hot August Night.
Mm.
And so I'd go over to friends' houses, and they were into, like, Black Sabbath and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they would put on their records, and I hated it. It was so noisy to me. And I'd go, can we listen to some Barbra Streisand? And they would want to just, like, beat me up. And then I got really into Jesus Christ Superstar. I lived with that. That record changed my life because that was kind of had rock. It was a rock opera.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned all the parts. Jesus, Judas, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
Like I would act out the parts. I would rub lotion on my own feet like I was Mary and then betray myself as Judas. Like I knew everything. And if you know what I'm talking about, betraying myself, then we're on the same page, babe. So
back to that Elvis story. You appreciated the rock, but you wanted the sophistication.
I did.
Story and you weren't satisfied with just a very loose verse, chorus, verse.
It was too noisy.
Yeah.
And then I discovered the Beatles,
mm.
got really into Revolver,
mm.
and got really into Rubber Soul, and then got really into the White Album, blew my mind.
Mm-hmm.
That opened my head up. I wasn't into Sgt. Pepper's, but I got really into Magical Mystery Tour. That's one of my favorite records to this day by the Beatles for some reason.
What's your favorite Beatles song?
Flying. It's an instrumental off of Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah.
I just love it. Mm-hmm. And Something in the Way She Moves. Mm. George Harrison. I think it's one of the most beautiful songs ever written. I love that song. Oh, and Taxman, because of the solo in it. Let me tell you how. That solo's insane.
That's Paul McCartney, actually.
Yeah, it is. Paul on the solo.
But you like the George compositions.
I like the George compositions. I love George Harrison. I was in New Zealand on tour with Jewel. And George, we would always stay in nice hotels. And I was walking, and coming in from the pool area was a guy, and he was walking towards me, and it was a glass door, and I'm walking that way. And I just go, oh, that's cool. That guy looks like George Harrison. That's neat. Look at him. And then as I open the door, he goes, oh, no, you first. And I go, that is George Harrison.
Mm.
And I just went, and I go, hi, George. And he goes, hello. And he walked by me, and that was it.
He didn't put you on his shoulders and swing around.
He just said hello. So that was pretty cool.
That's great.
Yeah.
Is that the only Beatle you've ever met?
Yeah, I didn't even really meet him, but I did. I talked to him.
Yeah, you did talk to him.
Yeah.
You exchanged acknowledgement.
Yeah, and it was cool that I met Liberace. Mm. He was one of my favorites too. I liked the dramatic flair, and so we would, we're really big in the States on Halloween. And trick-or-treating, where you go to people's houses and you say, trick-or-treat, and then they give you gifts. Well, we'd go to Liberace's house because he lived not that far from us.
Mm-hmm.
And we would trick-or-treat at his house. And Liberace loved Halloween. And he was dating his chauffeur, the blonde guy.
Mm.
And Liberace would have on boas and, like, rings on all his fingers. And he'd wear makeup. His hair was perfect. And he'd open the door and he'd go, hello, kids. Have a Snickers bar. And then we would leave. And I would change from being a ghost to being Batman. So I'd be somebody different and come back to get another one. Because he'd hand out full, big Snickers
bars. He gave out the good. He was the good house on the block.
Yeah.
And skimp.
It was amazing. And another thing I remember is the steps leading up to his house were piano keys, black and white keys, like a piano. However, they were like as if Lewis and Carroll did them, and they were all swirly.
Mm.
And with cactus by them, because it was Palm Springs,
right.
And the piano keys leading up to his house. It was really neat. And then when you rang his doorbell, it was like a Bach song or something.
Right, yeah.
Like, da, 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 or something. Not that's The Godfather, but, you know, it was like, da, 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 hello, kids.
Of course, it's got to have this song on there. Yeah. So you start playing in bands after high school, right?
Yeah.
And you started forming, you formed the Rugburns?
Yes, I did. What happened was I got really into the musical called Godspell. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that one?
Mm. A familiar of it, but not
I lived it. Like, it was another record I lived with. Okay, after that, I got really into Bob Dylan.
Mm.
I discovered Blonde on Blonde. That's what turned me on to Bob Dylan, the album Blonde on Blonde. My other uncle left it at the house, and I lived with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that blew my mind open. Mm. So, you know, when I heard him say, whoa, mama, could this really be the end to be stuck inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again? It was amazing. Mm. And so then I got out and I went to college. Then I started a band called the Rugburns.
Mm.
And that's where we started rocking.
Okay, so you started rocking, you started playing the different clubs. And then you were part of an ensemble or several different bands that would play these clubs together. Yeah.
Yeah. What happened was my sister got a job as a DJ on a college radio station at San Diego State. And the station was called KCR, the Live Wire, college radio. So I would go and they'd have these booths where you get vinyl records and you could sit and listen to them with headphones. They'd have listening booths back in the day. This is in 1979. Mm-hmm. And so you'd go and you'd check out records. So I would just look at the different records. And I remember I discovered this record called Rastamon Vibrations, Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Mm-hmm.
And I just flipped, listened to that. And I would just start experimenting. Well, my sister was on college radio and that's when punk rock started happening. So I was really into Jackson Browne by then. And then I got really into Pink Floyd, The Wall. Maybe it was 1980, I don't know, whenever that record came out. And then she said, turn this stuff off, listen to this, and handed me a record by a band called The Dickies, handed me Sex Pistols, handed me Elvis Costello, Joe Jackson. All this stuff was starting to come out.
In was the it 80s. Still noise to you? Or
no, it was awesome. And by then I really got it. And although I always liked Elvis Costello because he had smart lyrics, I liked the funny stuff too, like the Dead Milkman and stuff like that. more than the Dead Kennedys. I didn't like to hear people scream and be too angry. Mm-hmm. I liked music that had quirky...
You didn't want the political message. You didn't want the heavy-handedness.
Yeah. Right. I didn't mind it if it was a little political, but I wanted stuff to make me laugh. Mm-hmm. Like, I was always glued to Dr. Demento when I was a kid, and I would think, why can't these songs always be played? Mm-hmm. It started with the song, Hello, Mata, Hello, Fada, Here I Am at Camp Granada. Mm-hmm. And then by the time I heard Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road, I was like, why can't every song be funny? And they go, oh, those are novelty songs. And I go, well, they're better than a lot of this other music. Mm-hmm. You know, they were funny to me, and they were, you know, it's a long line of songs like that to the Hanukkah song or whatever.
Well, it sounds like you had a very good childhood, a nice upbringing, very mirthful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't really have, it didn't sound like you had a lot of anger.
No,
which
no.
is where a lot of that punk rock just kind of, that's the nerve that it twists in some people.
No, I get it. Yeah, yeah. I totally get it. And then, you know, I discovered so much music after that. I don't mean to sound so naive. Like, I got totally into Pavement, The Replacements. I mean, I can talk records all day long about all that stuff. This is just my journey started in a way that I think it was not cool.
Mm. Okay. Well, fair enough. Now, you started writing your own songs.
Yeah.
At what point did you realize you had a gift?
I never thought I could write songs. I was always playing guitar, and then I was always trying to write songs. But I was trying to write songs as if I was Jackson Browne or James Taylor. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write those songs, and I realized I wasn't going to do it finally. And what happened was, one day I wrote a song called Single Life, and you could hear that song. It's on a Rugburns record called Morning Wood. Mm-hmm. It might even be the opening track, but all I know is when I wrote that song, I teared up. I cried when I wrote it. Mm-hmm. And it was like this funny, brutally honest song, and I thought it had traces of a little bit of Loudon Wainwright in it, maybe a little bit of the Grateful Dead, and I knew I tapped into something.
Was that emotional reaction, I guess, happy with yourself? Was it a connection with the song?
It was a spiritual connection, and what happened was it was an awakening, and I'll never forget the day I wrote it. I was all alone in my apartment. What I realized was that was the day I really found my voice as a writer. It took me so long to find my voice, and what I mean is, not my voice that I sing with, but my voice.
What you wanted to say.
Yeah. And I realized, wow, only I can be me. Just like I'm the only one who has these fingerprints. My DNA is me, yet I was scared of my own DNA. Mm. I was trying to be somebody else. And when that happened and I wrote Single Life, I was really scared because we had started the Rugburns, but we were just like basically doing Beatles covers, and we were just kind of, it was a goof. It was a joke. And so I played that song. It was called Single Life, and I remember I did it that night. And on the break, I didn't say I wrote it or anything, and on the break people were coming up going, oh my God, I love that song you played. Who wrote that? That's so good. And I went, I did. And then people were like, what? You wrote that? And I said, yeah. And that, you need those attaboys to make you continue on. Mm-hmm. And so after I wrote it, I realized, wow, that actually connected with people. I really believe we have vibrations with music, and you either like it or you don't. If you don't, that's fine. Not everybody is. It's another big lesson you learn as a songwriter is you can't get everybody to like you. So just be you. And the more you can discover that devil may care attitude and be who you're going to be, that's when you get into the meat of the stuff. And so I wrote that song, and then from then on, I became really prolific. It was like, wow, here's my voice. And it's always been there with me since.
Mm-hmm. So that was 20 years ago, maybe?
I would say that was around 1985, okay, 86. Okay. Yeah.
And how steady have you written since? Are you a disciplined writer? I mean, do you use it like a muscle, or does your muscle come in spurts?
That's a good question. I've always said that I feel like it's three muscles. You got your songwriting muscle, and then you have your performance muscle, and you have your recording muscle. And so when you first start recording songs, you don't really know how to do it, and then you learn a few things. That muscle can get stronger if you keep doing it. And then you can just write songs all the time, but if you don't play them, your performance muscle is going to be really weak. So you'll get up, and you won't really be able to convey what you want to convey to the audience. And you need to get your 10,000 hours in, like Malcolm Gladwell says.
So it's like a three-legged stool. Any one those legs missing.
Well, because if you're going to write the songs, you need to perform them. And if you're going to perform them, then people want to buy them, and they want some semblance of what you just did on a recording. Mm-hmm. So it's never going to be perfect. But, yeah, I've always been prolific, and I've put out a lot of records, and I have a lot of songs I still need to record. And I find what works best for me is if I'm in a songwriting group and we have a title or a word that we have to use and deadlines. Mm-hmm. I used to think I'd have to wait till inspiration struck, but I don't believe in that anymore. What it really is if you have deadlines, that's the key. Because deadlines make you keep working, almost like you're a journalist. You're a newspaper man. You have to get that story in, you know, 160 words or whatever. You need to get it in, and they're ready for it. So if I have a song that's due, and I'm doing a songwriting game with a group of my peers that I respect, I don't want to turn in some piece of crap. I want to turn in something good. And so if you have one song a week due, you're going to end up with at least 50 songs in a year. And out of those 50, if you cull the herd, and you can end up with even 20% good songs. You have 10 really good songs you're adding. Now, that might not sound like a lot, but 10 really good songs to add to your repertoire, it's kind of like compounding interest.
Sure.
It really grows. Mm-hmm. Now, there's been some songwriting games where we did a song every 24 hours, you know, but I find a week is a good amount. And if you really do that, you end up with so many more songs. And then some of the ones that weren't good, you go back and rewrite them, and they're actually better than you thought. Mm-hmm. You have all these, as Tom Waits says, you have spare parts like in a junkyard, and you go back and steal the spare parts of the songs that weren't used. Mm-hmm. There might be a good verse in there, a couple good phrase even.
Yeah.
I learned that from Tom Waits.
Wow. Okay, so
reading an interview. I've never met him.
Okay, so you've got a group of peers that you work with, and online, I guess, you're touring around, and once a week you have a deadline. You have an assignment that you signed up for.
Yes.
What would the brief on that be? Write a song about bananas.
Oh, what it'll say is, all you have to do is say the word or words.
Okay.
So, sewing machine. Mm-hmm. That's this week. Not this week now, but I mean, that's what it would say. It'd say, hey, everybody, the phrase for this week is sewing machine. Next week, Christmas. Next week, raining gravel. Like, somebody will come up with something.
Okay.
And then
you don't have a list of them for a month. You just have it once a week.
Once a week, yeah. Okay. And then you start working on it, and they say it's due by midnight on Sunday night. And then everybody emails them, and you either listen to people's or you don't.
Okay.
It's not about a contest. It's about you doing your own work.
The discipline.
Nobody might even comment at all on your song for months. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's not like you're doing it to get attaboys on Facebook, like to get likes or right. comments. If you wanted to, you could put it on Facebook and all your friends are going to be like, that's so great, you're awesome. This is something where you don't get that praise, mm-hmm. but what you do get is the song. And then if you have the balls to do it, you do it. And I always have something new. Wherever I go, I have something new I'm working on. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I would die on the vine. And I've always been, I'm a really lucky artist in that I'm not tied to hit songs. I'm not like a guy who had a huge hit. I mean, I did through Jewel, but nobody expects to hear that. Mm. So I can always do new songs. People are coming to hear the commentary on the songs, to hear the shows. Of course they have favorite songs, don't get me wrong. Mm. But I'm not so tied to them that that's all I can do. I'm always allowed to do some new stuff, where a lot of artists can't do that. They got to do the oldies show, like John Fogerty, for instance. Mm-hmm. You're not going to see John Fogerty to hear him do 10 new songs. You're going to be pissed. You know, you want to hear
the Creedence catalog and at least Up to Center
Fortunate
Field.
Fortunate Son. Yeah, Up to Center Field. You want to hear those songs. Right. You'd be pissed. Right. Whereas Dylan does what the hell he wants. You don't even know they're his hits because they're so rewritten. And Neil Young's the same way. He does what he wants.
Yeah.
And Neil Young's one of my, you know, I look up to him mm-hmm. as somebody that I really admire. Same with Ani DiFranco.
Okay.
You know, somebody who's gone out there and earned it.
So if you could look at some folks out there like Neil Young, is that the sort of career you want to have?
Yeah, I love Neil's career because he does whatever the hell he wants to do. If he wants mm-hmm. to make a rock record, he makes a rock record. If he wants to make a country record, he does that. He'll do whatever the hell he wants. Mm-hmm. And I love his career. Lately, I've gotten really into the Grateful Dead, and I was never into them. And it's like peeling back layers of an onion now, because I'm listening to all these live recordings. And then that led me to all this Jerry Garcia band stuff, his solo stuff, and the stuff he did with Olden and The Way, this bluegrass stuff, and the stuff he did with Tony Rice. And it was weird because I got really sick 2 years ago and had a stroke and went blind. And then when my vision came back, I couldn't read, and I was in the hospital. And I didn't think I'd play guitar again. And that was just 2 years ago. And then I healed from the stroke. I didn't even know why I had the stroke. I had a blood clot in my brain. And, you know, I'm lucky I didn't die. And when I got out, I became a Deadhead. That, like, things change in the body. Right. It was the weirdest thing. All of a sudden, the Grateful Dead's music made sense to me. After the stroke. It's really weird. And now I do, like, I have, like, 8 of their songs I know really well. And I'll do a Dead song tonight in my show. I don't know which one. But I'm constantly learning a new Dead song. Mm. And so that's the other good thing I get to do. I get to do cover songs that I love. Like, John Hartford. I'll do classical guitar pieces because I grew up playing classical guitar. Mm-hmm. So I'll do a classical song. I'll do spoken word. Maybe I'll do a reading from The Godfather 2 where I'll do a part by Hyman Roth.
So maybe we'll hear that tonight.
Okay.
Okay. Now, you've been fortunate enough to have some hits that you've written. Specifically, You Were Meant For Me by Jewel.
Yes.
Now, at the time you were part of the band, you were opening for Jewel. And you'd written the song for Jewel. When did you know that that song started leading to a new level?
Well, we co-wrote it together, and we wrote it in Mexico, and then she got signed to to Atlantic Records after that by Danny Goldberg. And so then I still didn't think anything would happen. They listened to all these songs. She had like 300 songs on cassettes. Mm-hmm. So she gave them all to this producer who was Neil Young's pedal steel player in the Stray Gators. And his name, he's dead now. He was really cool. Mm. He was so good. Mm-hmm. Anyways, Ben Keith. So Ben Keith passed away, but anyways, Neil became a fan of Jewel's because she got a record deal and they said, why don't you go open for Neil Young? So she opened for Neil Young before her record was out even at Madison Square Garden, sold out. And Neil came back into her dressing room. He's like, how you doing, Jewel? And she goes, I'm freaking out. And he goes, why? And she said, because I'm opening for Neil Young at Madison Square Garden and it's sold out. And Neil Young goes, it's just another hash house on the road to success. Show him no respect. And then walks out. Such good
That's
advice.
That's cool.
So we had written You Were Meant For Me, and they were like, this is a hit. And I was like, that's a hit? And I was like, wow. So the song came out, and nothing happened for 9 or 10 months. They released it as a single, and the album was going to die at 30,000 copies sold, and that would have been the last you heard of Jewel. And then, for some reason, they said, You Were Meant For Me needs to be re-recorded by a pop producer. So they got this guy named Peter Collins. We had already recorded the record. We lived at Neil Young's ranch and made the record up there. And so they got this Peter Collins guy to redo the song, and he kept my guitar part but changed everything else and got Flea to play bass on it.
Flea, Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Red Hot Chili Peppers. Okay. So Flea played bass on that hit. And then Jewel re-sang it, and then she asked me to be in the video. And this is back when MTV was just, like, going off. And so it was at the end of grunge, and everybody was kind of tired of grunge. Like, you had Nirvana, and then you had
Pearl Jam,
and all the Seattle bands, you know. It was just like, it was overkill after a while. And then you got the copy bands, like
the manufactured bands.
Candelabra, Candlebox, who knows what they were called. But you got all these bands. And then all of a sudden, she was the recipient of good timing. Because it was like Joan Osborne,
Edie Brickell,
and Paula Cole, Sheryl Crow, Sarah McLachlan, Jewel. Jewel was on the cover of Time magazine. Lilith Fair came out. So what happened was they said, we think this song's going to be a hit. You Were Meant For Me. Next thing I know, my dad calls me, and he goes, man, your mom and I were watching MTV because our neighbors told us to turn on. That video's being played a lot, Steven. And I go, it is? And then everybody was like, you're the dude from the Jewel video. That thing became a smash hit. You Remember Me was on the top Billboard for like 100 weeks. It broke records. Mm-hmm. So next thing I know, huge checks started coming in the mail. And that song was so known. And when I knew it became a hit was one day I was driving down the road and there were four girls in a Jeep. And they had it cranked and they were all singing it. And I pulled up next to them and I looked at them and they looked at me. And I go, cool song, huh? Yeah, I wrote it with her. And they go, yeah, right, idiot. And then they drove off and they were just going, dreams last so long. And I was like, but I did. And I went, whoa, and they knew all the words. So that's when I knew.
When that when the girls pulled up in the car.
When they pulled up in a Jeep and they were in bikinis.
And they drove away from you.
Yeah, and they didn't want it. I'm the guy on the video. Don't you recognize me?
So you and that song, it still is just such a part of the psyche right now. You could pick out parts of it. Have you heard it in Muzak?
Oh, it's in Muzak. It's in stores. It's been in that show, The Office, with Steve Carell.
Right. Go ahead.
Insane. In The Office. Can you believe this?
No, I mean, it's probably in movies. Now, if James Cameron wanted to use it in a movie or something, do you get a phone call, or is there just a machine that, you know, takes care of it and sorts all that out, and you just see the back end of it?
I hope he would use it for somebody big. I could, you know where I could see it being used in the future is, like, some Will Ferrell movie where he's drunk and he sings karaoke to it. You know what I mean? Like, where he's like, and everybody's like, ah, remember that song? Because everybody knows it. It's in our DNA. Yeah. And I could see Will Carroll, like, Will Ferrell, I mean. Will Ferrell being really drunk, maybe running down the street naked.
Without a shirt on.
Yeah, without a shirt on.
Dreams with those man boots.
So long, even after you're gone. Like, I could see it being used like that. And I'll be happy if that happens. But no, I don't think I'd even get a, I think people would let me know that it happened. So I was the recipient of Good Timing, as was Jewel. And the fact that I co-wrote that with her and it sold, I think it sold 15 million records.
Holy shit.
The checks were huge that came in.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know what I did with the money.
Mm.
Those were the wild years.
But it must have been fun, yeah?
It was awesome, yeah. And there were other things that happened. Like I had a song that I wrote with another girlfriend named Anya Marina, and that got used in a Jeep ad, a huge Jeep ad during the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a song on the soundtrack to Notting Hill, a song on the soundtrack to Jack Frost that gets played every Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
So those are like... those are mailbox money gifts that keep giving, but I never really cared about, I never tried to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I really feel like, I don't know, I was in the right place at the right time, and nothing has changed in my life. I'm still doing what
You're still doing the work.
Yeah,
you're
still loading it's not like in. You saw me, I just sound checked. And
It's not like you've stopped. It's not like you said, that was my goal, and I've made it. It's like, okay, well, yeah, it's a bit of luck. If you're gonna write 1,000 songs, maybe one will hit.
Yes.
It was good that you got it early because it allowed you the freedom and the ability to do other things.
It did.
But you're still doing the work.
Yeah. And what was cool, I'm out here every day doing it, and I could win the lottery tomorrow, and I wouldn't change anything. I'd still be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need things. I have a guitar. Mm-hmm. I have a good pair of jeans. I have good shoes. I travel with only like one or two pairs of jeans and one pair of shoes, a couple shirts. The rest is merch I sell. It's like a game to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak started Apple Computer. It was a game to them when it started, building it in their garage to see what they could do. Mm-hmm. It's a game to me to build it, and every year it gets a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the tortoise and the hare. And it just slowly I chug along, and now...
Well, you got to be patient. I mean, when things happen overnight, they go away just as easily overnight.
Yes. But
here you're going to do a show tonight for how many hundred people?
Yeah.
And then next year you'll be here, it'll be that many people plus another 50.
Yeah. Like last night, two nights ago, it sold out at the Camelot. They turned people away. Last night I did Could You Diggers. Mm-hmm. Melbourne shows, I'm doing 5 now in Melbourne in different venues. They sell out or come close to it. And I get to travel and I get to do this. And I keep wanting to go to new areas and keep doing it. And it's like I'm the luckiest guy in the world that I get to do this. Because when you're really doing what you love, it's not about the money. The money is nice. What it's really about is about doing what you love and finding what it is that makes your spirit happy. Mm. And it's always been music for me, man. I couldn't have picked a better job. I will do this when I'm 80. Like, Willie Nelson's still doing it. Why can't I?
Sure. So, with the new year coming on, what's you going to do in 2017?
Well, I think for the first time, I won't be in Australia for a full year because I've been here twice this year. So, I think I'll come back in 2018 and do Port Ferry, do Blues Fest, hopefully, if I get that one. I'll definitely do Blue Mountain Festival, and I'll do Nan up in West Australia and play a bunch of shows. But maybe I'll come back to Australia. You never know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like it. I could even come back for a week and just do a couple one-offs. Mm-hmm. But I got a bunch of – since I've met you, which I met you a long time ago, I wasn't in the festival circuit yet. And now I'm in the festival circuit in the States, Canada, and Australia. And that's been a game changer for me because – when you're in the festival circuit, you get exposed to sometimes 2,000 to 3,000 people in a tent that you're playing music for that are there for the festival, not there to see you, but they happen to come by. And if you can convert them, they become fans of yours, and that really makes your following grow. And then the other thing is just, to quote Malcolm Gladwell again, the tipping point. Things start happening, you keep doing it, and if you do it long enough, somebody's finally going to go, you know, I've heard about this, and I get this all the time. I have heard your name for years. I finally came in. And I won't be back.
The first song, I hated you.
Yeah.
The second song, I really hated you. But yeah, eventually you turn those people and yeah, they become loyal.
So totally.
That's great. Would you be up for playing a song?
Sure.
Excellent.
This is how I made it. Song's true. You be pissing in a bottle and you can't see through the fog. You know a trucker jackknifed in the snow up ahead for sure. Radar got you clocked at 87 and a 55. Cops all want to search your car because they think you're high. Finally reached the club and they got no posters up. Play to 12 people, half a puking in a cup. Sell 2 CDs, give another 6 away. You're hoping that somebody is a place where you can stay. You got a 10-hour drive in the morning, don't sweat it. Keep thinking about the gig last night, you wish you could forget it. Listen to a podcast, a radio lab. Try to call your mom, but end up yelling at your dad. Car needs gas, so you're pulling to the come and go. The weather channel says that you're about to hit some snow. Sell 1 CD, give another 8 away. To add insult to injury, you had to pay to play. Cause you're a folk singer, folk singer. Yo, a washed up punk, still a dead ringer. For a folk singer, yo, a folk singer for sure. Get a big break and get to do some radio, but the DJ says it's taped for next week's show. Does you no good, cause tonight you got the gig. You keep on smiling and dance a little jig. Car starts whining and the engine's running hot. Gas station dude says your radiator's shot. Sell 12 CDs, give none away, but the radiator took it all, it's Groundhog Day. Yo, folk singer, folk singer, yo, a washed up clunk. Still a dead ringer for a folk singer, for a folk singer for show. The club owner says you should have played here last week, cause right now it's finals and no one makes a peep. He wishes that the money could have been a lot more, but the deal was only for a small percentage of the door. $27 and a couple foreign bills. Tried to pass a hat, but everyone was high on pills. Play a new song, no applause, just crickets. Bartender says I'll give you 2 drink tickets. Yo, folk singer, folk singer. Yo, a washed up punk, still a dead ringer. For a folk singer, yo, a folk singer for show. Get a good offer for a gig in Atlanta, but the airline send your guitar all the way to Montana. Get a real person on the phone from United. Lose your cool, tell the dude to go bite it. Borrow a guitar to try to cool your rage. Walk into the club and someone else is on stage. Sell no CDs, the club was double booked. You never even got to play, you feel your life is overlooked. Folk singer, folk singer, yo, a washed up punk. Still a dead ringer for a folk singer, yo, a folk singer for show. Finally get some sleep and there's a nice blue sky, and the airlines found your guitar all the way in Dubai. Said that it'll be there for your gig in Tallahassee, but you eat some bad food. Feeling
feeling kind of gassy. Get a Motel 6, wish it was the Ritz. At least you got a private place because you got the shit. Sell 5 hats, 2 CDs. Yes, sir, no, ma'am, thank you, please. Folk singer, folk singer. Yo, a washed up punk, still a dead ringer. Yo, a folk singer, yo, a folk singer for sure. Your manager grabs you right before you play a show and says, I think that you should dye your hair because it's white as snow. Girlfriend calls you as you leave the stage. She saw a picture of you with a chick and now she's in a rage. Break up, break down, break it all to hell. Charging all the damage to your hotel bill. Sell 5 stickers for 50 cents. Yo, a folk singer now, yo, about to make a dent. Finally get some good news from the booking agent dude. At the club tonight they'll give you half off on your food. Place is packed, gonna make you fee, but they wouldn't even turn off the sports TV. Feel like you climbed another rung on the ladder. Yo, another day older, another day fatter. I'm a folk singer now in the pale moonlight. That's how I'm gonna be standing on stage at the Basement Circular Quay in Sydney, Australia tonight. Cause I'm a folk singer, folk singer. I'm a washed up punk, still a dead ringer. I'm a folk singer, I'm a folk singer for sure. I'm a folkity folker, I'm a Bram Stoker joker. I'm a vampire smoker, I'm a mother folkin' folker today.
Yes, that was great. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, that is Steve Poltz. Make sure you check out him at his website, poltz.com, P-O-L-T-Z, or P-O-L-T-Z, depending on which continent you live into. Make sure to check out his tour dates. If he's coming around your town, make sure you go see him, support him. It's a fantastic show. Always has. This is now my probably 6th or 7th time seeing you live.
Yes.
It's always great. It's always fantastic. Pick up some of his CDs, some of his records, and some of his hats, and maybe some 50-cent stickers at Poltz.com. Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. This was awesome.
All good. Oh, that was awesome. Thank you very much, Steve. Much appreciated. Thanks for stopping by the show. It's always a great performance by Steve. He gives every performance his all, including that one he played just for you. So check out Steve's touring schedule at Poltz.com. Make sure you see him live. It's always a night to remember. Bring your friends, bring your buddies. You know, make it a girls' night out, a guys' night out, whatever. Be prepared to drink some beers, some wine, maybe some whiskey, and enjoy Steve. It's always a great show. Check it out, Poltz.com. All right, well, that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for downloading and listening. And thanks to all of you guys who've been sharing it with your record nerd friends. Really appreciate it. We got some great episodes coming up. So make sure you subscribe to this podcast. Don't just listen to it through the browser. Subscribe to it so it downloads automatically to your phone or your mobile device so you never miss an episode. You can do that at thevinylguide.com. All right. Well, that's it. Until next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.